Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm David Almos, Director of Publishing and Communications for the California Healthcare Foundation, which is co-sponsoring today's program. For more information on the Commonwealth Club and the California Healthcare Foundation, go to commonwealthclub.org or chcf.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Mike Levitt, Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Levitt has been the nation's top health care policy official since January 2005, when President Bush named him to head the largest civilian agency in the federal government. He has more than 65,000 employees and a $573 billion, yes, that's billion, dollar budget. Before taking his current post, Mr. Levitt was administrator of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. And before he joined President Bush's cabinet, he was elected to 3 terms as governor of Utah and was actually the nation's longest-serving governor at the time of his appointment to EPA. Some of Mr. Levitt's top goals have been to better integrate technology into the healthcare system, to modernize the federal Medicare and Medicaid programs, to spur programs to reduce medical errors, and to make the healthcare system more efficient. Along with his many years of public service, Mr. Levitt came to his current job with prior experience working in the private sector insurance industry, experience that he no doubt is able to bring to bear as he navigates our nation through such important changes as overseeing the new Medicare prescription drug program known as Part D, which is actually one of the biggest changes in Medicare in 40 years. Mr. Levitt was born in Utah and holds a bachelor's degree in economics and business from Southern Utah University. He and his wife Jacqueline are the parents of 5 children. It's now my great honor to welcome Secretary Mike Levitt.
Well, thank you. I am delighted to have been invited to such a distinguished setting to deliver some remarks. About a year ago this spring, I was invited actually by a call from the White House to speak on behalf of the President of the United States at the EER. I said to my assistant, well, tell them I'll do it, but see if you can find out a little about the EER. I was thinking it must be the European Economic something or other, and I had visions of blue and white airplanes. My assistant came back in and said, well, you won't have to worry about travel because I have found out that the EER is the Easter egg roll. And I made the president proud there. And it was a delightful event. But today I'm here to talk some about health care. I know a young couple who had an experience that I think is common to most parents. As was suggested in the introduction, my wife Jackie and I have 5 children, and we've been through every stage with them. Anyway, this couple had a little boy, an infant, and they had that awful experience that almost every parent has where their child got a cough and then that sort of wheezy, labored breathing that is, it's so frightening when your baby's not able to get a breath. And, well, they were parents on a mission for a solution, and they found one in an oxygen tent in a community hospital. A few days later, they got the bill. And it could have been one of those credit card commercials. Night in an emergency room, $2,000. Knowing that your baby can breathe, priceless. Any conversation about health care needs to be started in this context. We need to acknowledge that in health care, that in life, sometimes life trumps supply and demand. And in healthcare, though things are priceless, they are not price-free. And if I were to title my remarks today, it would be Making Peace Between Priceless and Pricey. That's the dilemma. In fact, the price of healthcare is growing at such a staggering rate that It is beginning to challenge many of the other things that we value. a recent edition of Health Affairs, a magazine published by the Department of Health and Human Services, reported that the $1.9 trillion we now spend on health care is now 16% of the gross domestic product. That is to say, of all the goods and services that happen in the entire economy, 16% of them involve health care. It went on to project that by 2015, it would be 20% of the gross domestic product. One program within HHS now constitutes, it's Medicare, now constitutes 3.4% of the gross domestic product. One program. The Health Affairs report projected that if it's allowed to continue on its current course, Medicare alone by 2040 would be 8%, and by 2070 it would be 14%. Now, like you, I find myself being quite skeptical about that kind of logarithmic projections of trends. In this particular case, I am somewhat skeptical for this reason. It can't be allowed to happen. It won't happen. The system will have either changed or we will have been eliminated from the economic competition, because there is no place on earth, or at least there is no place on the economic leaderboard for a nation that devotes that much of its economy to one sector. Now, obviously, this plays out in many different ways. At the breadwinner level, it plays out. There are 45 million Americans who don't have health insurance, and the number increases as the price goes up. A lot of things contribute to the skyrocketing cost of health insurance and of health care generally. We have an epidemic of chronic disease, diabetes, heart ailments. Many of them are driven by obesity and overweight. We currently have three times the number of children between ages 6 and 18 who are obese and overweight than we did in just 1980. That will lead to an inevitable consequence of more diabetes, more chronic disease, more health care costs. Health care is also saturated with inefficiency and, frankly, poorly aligned incentives. Now, I've learned over time this is not a case I have to make, because everyone has had their own experience. They've either been to the emergency room for a $2,000 visit, or they purchased a medical device that was outrageously pricey, or they had some other experience that persuaded them of the inefficiency of the system. I've found that there's one way to spark a dinner conversation, and that's to tell a story about the healthcare system. Everybody has one. Now, a lot has been said over the course of the last several years about the disconnection between consuming health care and those who are paying for it. Now, this is a fundamental problem, and a lot more needs to be said about it, because it's at the heart, in my judgment, of how we go forward. But not only is there a disconnection of incentive, but people have no idea of knowing what they're paying, or for that matter, how high quality what they're paying for is. In fact, medical financing as a system routinely hides the ball. People don't have a clue what they're paying. People don't have a clue the value of what they're paying for. People deserve to know. In fact, people have a right to know the quality of the care that they're receiving and its cost. And every consumer should have a reason to look for the best value. And frankly, none of that's happening right now, or at least very little. I've noted over 15 years of working at this that changing the healthcare system is a politically difficult task. Years have taught me that there, well, and people talk about political will, and they suggest maybe there's a shortage of political will. I'd offer you a different take. There is an abundance of political will. The problem is every time something's put on the table, everyone's political will comes out, and it faces each other, and what we end up with is with a standoff, a perpetual standoff. Occasionally, something will happen, but by the time it finds its way into legislation, it has been reduced to the lowest common denominator, and it lacks the sense of boldness that requires to make this kind of change. An urgent need exists to ignite a powerful force of change in healthcare. For that to occur, a new kind of public leadership will be required. The kind of leadership that can only come from one source. The people who pay for it. Payer power. Large employers for many years have rallied together to because they feel the weight of this. They've been agitating for change, but they have been missing a significant component in the mix. That's the federal government. Medicare, Medicaid, the Department of Defense, the Office of Personnel Management, the Veterans Administration, other public payers make up 46% of the entire payer market. So the idea of being able to move the market, if you will, by simply taking the part that is left has resulted in a lack of critical mass. That needs to change, and it will. The president has asked the providers of health care nationwide to disclose the walk-in prices that they post to Americans. They need to post it in their facilities. They need to post it on the internet. He's asked insurance companies to disclose their negotiated prices for those who enroll in their plans. May I suggest that alone will make a significant change? Last night I stayed at a hotel here in San Francisco. There was a small sign on the back of the door that said the price of the room was $449. Now, you will be relieved, as will all taxpayers, that I didn't pay $449. I paid $130. The bill was slipped under the door in the middle of the night. I paid $130 instead of $440 because someone had negotiated a corporate deal or a government deal with the hotel. The same happens in healthcare every day. However, that couple I told you about who took their child in for the $2,000 visit, they were uninsured. Had they been insured, the cost would have been more like $500. People have a right to know. People need to know the cost of their care and the quality of the care. In coming months, as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, I am going to launch, with others, actions that will be designed to systematically bring this nation's health care payers together to lead toward change, a change that will create greater transparency in quality and in price. I'm announcing today that for the first time, Medicare, Medicaid, the Department of Defense, and the Office of Personnel Management will be compiling non-personalized claim information and releasing the information in sufficient detail that it will be statistically reliable and can serve as a foundation for transparent price and quality data that will be available on hospitals and physicians. We'll start with a few of the most common procedures, and we'll expand it as quickly as possible. Now, this is a very important policy change because it begins to move us toward people knowing what they pay and knowing the quality of what they're receiving. The American healthcare system actually is a network of local and regional markets. We think of it as an American system, but it actually is a network of local systems. Change will need to begin once we've been able to provide significant payers of information within those regional markets with information. What we'll be doing over the next several months is analyzing metropolitan markets. And then as Secretary of Health and Human Services, I'm going to go to those markets and we're going to find the largest employers. And we're going to ask those employers to join with the public payers in taking on four very significant initiatives. The first initiative is quality transparency. We will ask those who are private payers, along with the public payers, to make a condition of their business with insurers and third-party administrators, the providing of quality information, and the adoption of the AQA or HQA standards. Those are groups that have come together to create standards on quality. We'll first start off with the first 20 most frequently used procedures and go from there. The second initiative is price transparency. We'll ask again, as a condition of doing business, that insurers and third-party administrators disclose the prices on their most frequent medical procedures. To be most useful, consumers will then have a clear picture of the overall cost, not just the procedure, but all of the costs. The vision here is for consumers to have a better picture of what they're buying and how good it is, and we're talking about the kind of consumer information that you get on virtually any other purchase. Let's just take a hip replacement, for example. This would change the healthcare world if people could know in advance of their operation what the overall cost of the operation would be. That would include lab tests, anesthesia, the rehab costs, specific information on quality, like complication rates and patient satisfaction, would also be very helpful. That information would put the incentives in the right place. It would give an incentive to lower the cost and to increase the quality. So let me repeat. People need to know, they have a right to know, the cost of what they buy and the quality that they're receiving. Competition and transparency will make the system better. The third thing that they will endeavor to do collectively with this payer power is to move toward a system that will involve interoperable electronic medical records. We will start by developing a system on a standardized basis that will do away with the medical clipboard as we know it. How many times do we walk into a clinic or a doctor's office or any other place involving our health care and we're handed a clipboard? And we write down our name and our address and our phone number and our insurance number and other pieces of information, not once, but several different times. Now, in the information world age, there ought to be a way to improve that. And with payer power, we'll move forward collectively to ask those who are insurers and providers to adopt standards that are being developed over the course of some period of time. It will be an important step forward in harnessing the power of the electronic medical record. The fourth is consumer-oriented purchases. Making a health savings account a voluntary option as part of their offerings to employees. So price transparency, quality transparency, electronic medical records, and making medical savings accounts or health savings accounts one option as part of their offerings to employees. Now, that will be a very important and a powerful step forward. There are currently 3.5 million people who have adopted for health savings accounts. The trend will grow. It'll grow for a number of reasons. One is that it's more people will buy insurance when it's $300 a month than when it's $600 a month. It's as simple as that. And it will also resolve a very important inequity in the system. And that is that there's no reason that people should have to pay taxes on the money that they pay health care with. A health savings account resolves both of those. Now, this is just one step in making peace between priceless values of health and of health care and the pricey reality of economic competitiveness. I'd like today to just speak briefly about one very important innovation in healthcare that is already underway, and that is the prescription drug benefit, Part D. It's important that this is viewed in the context of a reform. For the last 40 years, Medicare has been paying for heart operations that cost $100,000 or more. But we've been unable to pay $1,000 of prescription drugs that would have prevented it in the first place. This is a profoundly important change, perhaps the biggest change in healthcare in some 40 years. Now, there are roughly 1.1 million Californians who have not yet enrolled. They have until May 15th to enroll without additional premium being charged. If you're there and listening to me and you're 65 years of age or older and or you're qualified because of Medicare, I simply want to say this is a good deal. And this is the deal. If you'll spend about an hour in figuring out the best place to send your prescription drug bills, Part D will pay at least half, perhaps more, for the rest of your life. Now, that's a good deal for seniors. I would also like, in the time we have concluded, to talk a little bit about another issue. And if you have questions about this in the question period, I'd like to respond to them. I'd like to talk about pandemic influenza. Secretary Chertoff will be here on Friday. He undoubtedly will talk some about Katrina. I spent weeks during Katrina going through medical shelters in the Gulf region. I learned that there are some very important differences in the way we manage a pandemic than any other natural disaster. Katrina was a devastating natural disaster that included major parts of Alabama, Mississippi, and virtually all of Louisiana. But at least it was confined to that area. A pandemic would be happening in Seattle and Santa Fe and Sarasota and Syracuse all at the same time, and add to that list San Francisco. It may be happening in as many as 5,000 different communities at the same time. Any community that fails to prepare with the expectation that the federal government will be able to step in and rescue them at the last moment will be sadly disappointed. Not because we lack will, not because we lack wallet, but because we lack a way. There is no way that any governmental agency will be able to reach out to every community at the same time. Local preparedness is the foundation of preparation for a pandemic. The second difference is the time frame. A pandemic occurs over a year or a year and a half. Most of the natural disasters we prepare for happen in a period of 3 or 4 days, and then we move into recovery. Life must go on. What that means is that to be prepared as a nation, every city, every state, every tribe, every county, every business, every church, every school, every college, every faith-based organization, every household needs to be thinking on how they would deal in a pandemic situation. Pandemics happen. They have happened for centuries in the past, and there's no reason to believe that the 21st century will be any different. So today, as I close, let me just remind you that our task is to reconcile and to bring peace between the priceless value of life and the pricey reality of our economic competitiveness. By approaching price transparency, by finding quality transparency, by turning the incentives of the market in ways that will create favor, we can move forward, and I look forward to entertaining your questions. Thank you.
Our thanks to Secretary Leavitt for his comments today. I'm Brooke Byers, a partner at Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers, and I'll be conducting the question and answer portion of the program. We have a large number of questions. This is a very inquisitive audience you have here, Secretary Leavitt. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services, who is talking about the current and future U.S. healthcare system. Questions from our audience. Secretary Leavitt, you talked about health savings accounts, and how would you propose to address the possible risk selection issues presented by health savings accounts where younger, healthier individuals self-select into low-cost catastrophic care, where then an increasingly unhealthy, high-cost population would go into the more traditional insurance plans?
First of all, let me say that I believe health savings accounts will be very attractive to those who are young and healthy. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing because many of them are currently not insured. And I will say, generally speaking, people who are buying insurance will buy a lesser expensive plan than they will a plan of greater expense. We have now 3.5 million people in the United States. We're finding that the demographics of those 3.5 million people do not support the theory that there will be adverse selection. We see quite a cross-section. One thing we see is that, at least up to this point, about 37% of them are uninsured previously. So they're people who don't have insurance. If you strip it down, what a health savings account does is that it resolves the inequity of some people in this country paying income tax on the dollars they spend on health care and others not. It resolves that issue, and the second thing it does is that it provides a means by which lesser expensive insurance can be offered because it's essentially catastrophic coverage. Over time, we do need to make certain that those who have chronic illnesses are not disadvantaged. All a health savings account does is affects the first $1,000 or $2,000. After that, it acts essentially like any other insurance policy.
With 45 million Americans estimated to not have any health insurance, how will these programs solve that problem?
Well, again, I'll make clear that one thing we know about our insurance system is that the more expensive it gets, the fewer people have it. And so at the heart of access needs to be keeping costs constrained, and at the heart of keeping costs constrained needs to be the ability for people to know what they're buying and have information about the quality of it. It's vital that when we talk about health costs that we continue to come back to the whole concept of keeping people well, not just treating them after they're sick. That has to become the fundamental strategy change that we make in America. We've thought of health care as treating people after they're ill over and over and over again. It's the construct of our health care system. We need to begin focusing on how we keep people healthy. Now, we're moving in a way in medicine that will make medicine far more preventative, will make it far more preemptive, and will make it far more personalized. That can make medicine more expensive, or it can begin to take the overall cost and bring it down because we keep people healthy, not just pay for them after they're sick. And that's why this obesity issue is so vital. It is a leading cause of so many of the chronic diseases that create so much of the expense. Most of you are aware that 75% of that $1.9 trillion that we spend is on chronic disease. Chronic diseases are, by their nature, in large measure preventable, or at least the complications of chronic disease is preventable. So the more we can bring the costs of our health care down, the more people who will ultimately have insurance. Now, I need to tell you that I see the difficulties of our financing system, and they need to be addressed. I think health savings accounts are an important first step, but they're only a first step.
You mentioned a case where a family took a patient to an emergency room for an emergency situation. Often, though, the 45 million people in the United States without health care insurance go to the emergency room just to see a physician. That obviously is a high-cost use of the system. So wouldn't it be less expensive for the nation as a whole to have an across-the-board fundamental insurance system for everyone?
Everyone needs to have a medical home. The President and others in Congress have been supporting the expansion of our community health system. We now have thousands of them, of community health centers. We'll be expanding another 302 of them this year. But I learned something this last week that was interesting to me. And that is, a major health care provider indicated that if a person does not make over 200% of the poverty level when they walk into a hospital, they don't even send them a bill if they make under 200% of the poverty level. What that means then is that bill is being factored in all of the other bills, and those who have insurance are paying for them. It's very clear to me that the money exists if we're able to find ways of distributing it in a way that's more efficient. That's one of the reasons that our Medicaid system is so badly in need of reform. We have used Medicaid as the means of being able to help people who need assistance in buying insurance. The reality is there's a far more efficient way to do that. There are plenty of dollars in this system. We just need to find ways in which to reallocate it in an efficient way.
That gets to this next question about cross-subsidization, because Medicare and Medicaid are known to pay less than private insurance for procedures and for doctor charges and hospital charges. So in a way, the private insurance system helps cover that. We need to maintain the healthcare system and payments to encourage doctors and hospitals to operate. So can this all work out? If you publish prices and then prices from private insurance come down, how can the healthcare system still function?
Until we have price transparency and people know what's being charged, the system can never be repaired, in my judgment. We need price transparency. People need to know what it is they're being charged, and they need to know what the quality is. That having price and quality together is essential. It's easy to get low price. It's easy to get quality. But getting price and quality together is where value is presented. Having price transparency, quality measures that are real, will in fact have a profound impact on the healthcare financing system.
I know you've been an advocate, this questioner asks, of greater use of health information networks, electronic prescribing, electronic medical record, to have more transparency in the healthcare system, share information, and more efficiency. How do you balance that against the privacy concerns of individuals about their healthcare record?
Let's just acknowledge that privacy is a prerequisite to any discussion of electronic medical records. We have this dilemma not just in healthcare, but in virtually every transaction that we do, whether it's a credit card, buying lunch at a restaurant, or whether we're doing it in any other setting. This is something that society is generally wrestling with, and we're all going to have to make both social adjustments and have a system that will accommodate it. But I believe it can be done, in fact, and is being done, and it will ultimately be a reflection of having people have a choice of whether they want the benefit of the information or whether they have great concerns about the privacy of their information. I believe it can be protected using the technology, but it always involves some choice and some compromise on the part of those who are getting the benefit of it.
And as in most programs, they'll work better down at the state and local level. So how will the efforts of the federal government and HHS and setting standards or other programs work down at the state level? What's the responsibility of the state level in that?
The fundamental construct of privacy in America is a federal law called HIPAA. And then states have the opportunity to make their laws more stringent if they choose. And there are some 32 states who have made laws more stringent than HIPAA in certain categories. So as we begin to weave together a network of electronic medical records and the capacity to change information from one area to another, we are going to have a means of being able to accommodate those differences. Some of that may require a need for states to adopt more standardized approaches. It may also require that the system have the electronic capacity to navigate those differences. But make no mistake about it, and unless we're able to accommodate the privacy concerns of consumers, electronic medical records will never have the foothold they need to make a substantial impact on health care costs or quality.
Here's a question about Medicare plans. Is there a measure or a thought in progress to include birth control in Medicare plans?
I don't know the answer to that. I feel confident that someone on Capitol Hill is talking about it, but it has not been a discussion I've been part of.
Okay, thank you. What is the thinking on the Medicare Part D innovations that are going on now, and the effect that will have near or long term on the prices or costs of drugs?
Thank you. We have already begun to see prices in the prescription drug market drop, I think in large measure because of the Part D. When we started a little over a year and a half ago on preparing for this, the government actuary estimated that the cost would be $37 a month on average for beneficiaries. We now see costs below $25 a month. It will save literally billions of dollars for taxpayers and consumers, and I believe that's in large measure because for the first time we have an organized marketplace in the prescription drug market. We have a lot of pharmaceutical companies who are hearing from the prescription drug plans, if you don't give me the lowest possible price, I can't be competitive and I won't do business with you. And we have enough different drugs in each class that it's beginning to drive a competitive market. And I think in large measure we're seeing again the value of price transparency and quality measurements. This is a good example of how it makes a difference in the marketplace to have competitive competitive choices.
You know, the range of your department is astonishing. It includes not only Medicare, Medicaid, which we've talked about, innovation in healthcare information technology, the Centers for Disease Control, the Federal FDA, and other programs. If we could move to some of those other, because FDA not only covers drugs, but it covers food safety in our country and is used as a standard around the world. This past week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a food labeling bill that would preempt individual state food labeling laws, such as the ones that California passed and are quite strict and specific. How would that law, if passed by the Senate and signed by the President, affect California state law? Would it preempt it, or what would the effect be?
Could you describe it again? I'm not sure I picked up on what it was you were describing.
Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a food labeling bill. How would that affect California's current food labeling laws?
As you can all appreciate, this is a big country, 50 different states, all of whom have different interests, standards, and values. When we're dealing with matters related to interstate commerce, there is where food can be passed and sold in different states by one company, there is a need for a standard. And I think at the heart of this issue is how can we accommodate the need for interstate commerce. There's little question if Congress acts that it will preempt any state labeling law and become the primary law for reasons that I think are evident to all of us. If you're going to be selling a box of a product in California, you're likely going to be selling it in Texas or in Florida, and having a standard for labeling is a critical part of being able to maintain the efficiency needed for the economy to work.
Would states still be able to have their own labeling laws, even if that bill passes?
It would depend on the way the bill is written. In some cases, they actually create the means for a state to do that. Where you're dealing with labeling of products, my guess is that it would, and I haven't read the bill, I don't know, but my guess is it'll be preemptive and would essentially create a single standard in the same way we have other labeling standards. Many times states lead in this effort because they act before Congress, but typically when Congress gets into the game, and if it's for products that are sold nationwide, there's a need for a uniform standard. That's the reason, for example, that the Food and Drug Administration is the national authority on drug safety or on food safety. It's because it generally involved in interstate commerce and a natural task for the federal government.
For our radio listeners, I want to remind you that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services, Mike Leavitt, who's talking about the current and future U.S. healthcare system. So, Secretary Leavitt, we have some questions now about incentives. You mentioned the use of healthcare information technology to bring efficiency. Now, when it gets down to the doctor level, a recent estimate is only 13% of U.S. doctors use any e-prescribing. That would be a computer or a handheld device to write and send prescriptions, which obviously would reduce medical error. What incentives or what can be done to encourage more adoption of these methods?
Let me describe, if I can, a dilemma that is faced generally in the development of electronic medical records. This is a very good example. There are two parts of this debate. One is adoption, that is to say, what can we do to incent people to adopt the technology, to buy the computers, to put in the software. And the second is how do we make certain that they can talk to each other. I was not far from here. I was at Stanford or at a clinic related to Stanford not long ago, and I walked up to a pathology bench where I saw a group of students working on making a diagnosis, and there was a young pathologist who said, I'm just about ready to leave Stanford and I'm going to go practice, and I heard your speech about electronic medical records, and I want you to know I buy everything you said. I just have one question. What system should I buy? Well, I told him I wasn't able to answer that. I wasn't able to answer it, not only for proprietary reasons, but because there is no answer to it right now. What I told him was what's important is that you're able to operate interactively with the people that you need to have consultation with and that you interact with in terms of your medical practice. That's true for all of us. I was in a large city in the Midwest. I went to a terrific hospital. It had remarkable medical records, and across the street was a county hospital, and just down the road there was a children's hospital. I sat at lunch with all three of the administrators, and they told me about systems that they had purchased, each of which cost over $100 million. They all bought them from separate vendors, and none of them could talk to each other. It reminded me of an incident that occurred not long before that. I've been studying railroads. I've been studying them because of the problem they had in being able to connect themselves to one another. They all had different rail gauges. That is to say, the width of the tracks. With some very good leadership, in about 30 years, Abraham Lincoln was able to bring them together to have a 5-foot wide, I think it's 4-foot 8 inches wide rail gauge, and that's the standard, and any train that runs in the United States has that rail gauge. I was telling a friend of mine about this. He said, you know, I had an uncle in 1960 that went to Australia as an engineer to help them solve this problem. So I was curious about it. I put it into my search engine, and up popped a whole list of articles about Australian rail gauges. What fascinated me was that they were current articles. And what I discovered was that there is still, after 150 years in Australia, this raging debate going over the width of the railways. And today, if you're in Australia and you want to go from point A to point C, you have to stop in point B and change trains because the trains don't fit the rail gauges. Now, we've essentially got that problem in the United States in our healthcare system. We have lots of places that can provide remarkable electronic medical records, but the rail gauges don't match. So we have this dilemma. Do we send everyone off to buy a computer and to become for the capacity to be able to send a prescription to one drugstore and back? No. They want to be able to deal with all of the drugstores at the same time. I mean, our vision is that a person can walk into a doctor, get their prescription, and have it being filled at their neighborhood pharmacy before they leave the doctor's parking lot. That's eminently achievable. But to do it, we have to create a series of standards. Now, there are three ways to create standards. You can say the government will figure out what they are. Well, that doesn't work. We'd probably pick the wrong standard on our own. The second is what I like to call the last vendor standing. Whoever can still be standing at the end of the day, we'll call them the standard. Well, that doesn't work because there are too many people who have good ideas and can accomplish the same task. The best option is good old-fashioned collaboration where you get together and figure out what the best one is and adopt it. Now, I would argue that what I talked earlier about with health transparency and price transparency, we're going through the same process. We have to go through good old-fashioned collaboration and then all get behind the same standard. Now, in electronic medical records, that's exactly what we're doing. We have put together a collaborative process. I mentioned earlier this medical clipboard project. I want to see the medical clipboard become a thing of the past. There is no reason that we ought to have to fill that out as many times as we do. I look forward to the day when I can go into a clinic, initiate through an identifier that I create, all of the information about my health care, about my health, about my health history. I went into a clinic not long ago. I had to get one of those age 50 plus tests, and as I was sitting on the table waiting, the doctor said, "Okay, one more time. Let's go through this and ask a few questions." And he asked a few questions, and then I got ready for the test. I said, "Oh, by the way, I probably ought to tell you before you give me anesthesia that I have sleep apnea." He said, "You have sleep apnea?" I said, "I do." He said, "That's a very important thing for me to know before I give you anesthesia." Well, that was a medical mistake. It was one I made. But it's not one I should have been called upon sitting on the test table to tell my doctor. It should have been in my medical record, and it should have been there once and for all. I saw this play out over and over in Katrina. We had 1.4 million people who were who were displaced from their home, and with them went their medical records. Now, the irony of that is, in 1 week, using available information, we were able to reconstruct the prescription drug records of 1.4 million people and allow them to be available to any doctor in the United States with a protected password on the Internet. Now, don't tell me we can't create a prescription drug record that can be accessible to any consumer. We can do this. But it is going to require good old-fashioned collaboration. Now, back to the question. So should we just go out and encourage people to buy computers so they can have e-prescribing, or should we get a system together that allows them to use it? They have to happen at the same time. Having a system that no one subscribes to doesn't work. On the other hand, having a system where lots of people have computers but there's no system, you get the dilemma.
Along those lines, at the end of the day, there has to be a standard. And this person asks, it seems in the U.S. what we do is we don't like to impose a standard, so we end up with a variety of them, witness our wireless networks and our cell systems that are not as good as in Europe and other parts of the world. So is waiting for that standard to evolve the right thing to do, or shouldn't the government just pick one so that all the manufacturers know what to work to?
This is a great question. It doesn't just apply in health IT. It goes back to the area of transparency that I talked about earlier. I believe there is a new version of public leadership that needs to emerge here, and I've talked about it. It's payer power. The government is a huge payer, and we need to be part of the equation. What we're doing with health IT standards is this: we're bringing a large collaboration together and saying, "All right, let's solve this medical registration problem. Let's create a system that will, in fact, allow for medical registration to be done uniformly. And then Medicaid, Medicare, DOD, VA, we will adopt it." Now, if it's us coming up with the standard, we might choose the wrong one. So let's include the private sector, and let's all decide together what the best system is, and then the federal government will adopt it, along with a large group of private payers, and when they do, it moves the market and the establishment of the standard is set. And that's what you will see happening with health IT standards. It's also what I announced today with quality transparency and price transparency. The payer power of the federal government, working in conjunction with private employers, will create a momentum for change that cannot be accomplished legislatively.
Back on the topic of the economic system and how incentives work, if U.S. drug prices are forced down by market forces or government mandate or Medicare negotiation, whatever reason, won't that affect pharmaceutical R&D, because other countries in the world that have already set price controls are not carrying their share of the R&D burden?
The questioner is correct. That's you. That's correct, in my judgment. There are other countries who aren't paying their proportionate share. Those are trade problems we need to solve. We need to solve them. They need to pay their share. In my mind, the brilliance of a supply and demand system is that it finds the right price. It'll find the lowest price, but it'll also find the right price. It'll find the lowest price under which we can continue to have a robust market of research, development, and innovation.
Okay, I've got quite a few questions from the audience about avian flu, a big topic where there's a lot of confusion. So I want to start with something you've said recently, which is you think this is one of the most serious threats to American security and to American health and global health since threats like this know no boundaries. Could you start out by giving an overview of what you think are the chances of an avian flu pandemic coming in the next 5 to 10 years, and what your department's doing about it?
First, let me clearly remind us all that pandemics happen. They have happened since the beginning of man. They are a biologic fact of life. There's nothing new here. You can go back as far as recorded history and see that when they occur, they not only cause the health of many to decline and the lives of many to be lost, but they change the nature of cultures, they change the nature of the prosperity of nations, and they change the politics of nations. Athens in 430 BC, the first recorded pandemic, 25% of that city is wiped out very quickly. We're not sure what it was, but it was clearly an epidemic. Roll forward periodically, go to 1400 AD, Black Death, the most well-known pandemic. 25 million people in Europe die in a very short period of time. We have had 10 pandemics in the last 300 years. We have had 3 pandemics in the last 100 years. Pandemics happen, and there is no reason to believe that the 21st century will be different than centuries past, because we're dealing with rudimentary biology here. Now, what is the likelihood that the H5N1 virus is the spark that will trigger the next pandemic? That is a question I have asked the leading scientists in this area around the world, and the truth is we just don't know. What we do know is that the warning signs are there. Why are we concerned about this particular virus? We're concerned because this virus has genetic similarities to the virus that caused the pandemic of 1918, when 40 million people around the world died, the equivalent in the United States of 2 million today. Were we to have a pandemic of similar proportion to that which occurred in 1918, in this country we would have 90 million people sick. 45 million of them would be sick enough that they would require medical attention, and 2 million people would regrettably pass away. We're concerned about it for a second reason, the first reason is it's sweeping the world. If I could give you a picture here, I think might help you understand, did me. Think of a virus like it was a 32-bit encrypted code. This is the code to human transmissibility. If we were to try to crack that code, we would take a computer and we would begin to send series of numbers against it with the idea that sooner or later we'd get lucky and hit the right sequence. If we had 2 computers, it would increase the likelihood of that happening. If we had 10 computers, it would increase it even further. If we had 1,000 computers, it would increase it even further. That's essentially what's happening with the H5N1 virus. As it spreads across the world, there are more and more viruses that are in a situation where they can continue to try to find the combination of human transmissibility. Now, we don't know with any certainty that this virus will. What we do know is that there will be one in the future, whether it's 5 years or 10 years, no one knows. But when it comes to a pandemic, we're overdue and we're underprepared. So our effort today is to inform people, not to inflame them. Our effort is to try to inspire them to prepare, not to panic. We don't know if it will be the triggering virus. What we do know is that ultimately we will have an event. There are some things we prepare for because we know they'll happen. There are other things we prepare for because if they happen and we're not prepared, the consequence is substantial. A pandemic is both.
So let's talk about stockpiling, since that's a term that's used often. And you mentioned earlier in your remarks efforts needed at the federal, that's across the nation level, state level, local level, even individual level and in our homes. So on national stockpiling, Congress approved $3.8 billion for expenditure against the president's request of $7.1 billion just in the past few months. And $3.3 billion of that is to be allocated by your department. What are you spending it on?
The majority of the $3.3 billion that Congress appropriated will go to vaccines. A portion of it will also go to antiviral medications, and a significant piece of it will go to state and local preparedness. Now, I want to emphasize that I believe the foundation of pandemic preparedness is local preparation, and we're in the midst now of 50 state pandemic summits, working to inform states of their obligation and to reach beyond state governments and city governments to schools, to businesses, to churches, and to families to say, here are the things that you can do to prepare. There are some functions that the federal government is uniquely able to accomplish, the development of vaccines, the development of antivirals, and so forth. That is the focus of the federal government's allocations, but we're working hard to make certain that local governments are undertaking the needed precautions.
Then, do the local and state governments have enough money to do their share of it? So how will cost sharing be done between the federal and those local governments?
An important component here is an understanding the way a pandemic will likely unfold when it does. We live in a time when we're accustomed to having a pill or a vaccine or some kind of potion for anything that could go wrong. That's our expectation. We're dealing with a biology that currently there is no human immunity for, or it wouldn't be a pandemic virus. It takes about 6 months to create a vaccine after we've identified the virus. Currently, we don't have the capacity to manufacture enough vaccine for every American. The bulk of our expenditure is going to change that. But even if we had the capacity to create 300 million courses of a vaccine within 6 months, it's important to realize that the first 6 months will likely be without a vaccine. What that means is that we will be dealing with basic and traditional public health measures. That means that social distancing in various iterations will be the means by which we protect ourselves. Those don't cost a lot of money. What costs a lot of money is teaching people how to do it. We will also have needs for surge capacity. If you were to ask me what the two things I'm most concerned about in a pandemic situation, frankly, they're the same two things that I'm worried about in a bioterrorism event or a nuclear event or, for that matter, in any significant medical emergency. It's surge capacity. How do you deal with thousands of people trying to get access to the same limited number of medical facilities at the same moment, and distribution? How do we take the medications that we do have and allocate them, or how do we get them into the hands and distribute them in a timely way? We will have stockpiles of Tamiflu and other antivirals sufficient to supply 25% of the U.S. population. Why 25%? Well, that's about the size of the population that would ultimately be affected in a pandemic. Having them isn't the important thing. Being able to get pills into the palms of people in a very short time is how we ultimately measure our success. So that's what we need to be working on, is not just having stockpiles, but having the capacity to deliver them at the right time. Now, let me just say in a positive way, pandemics are not just the history of public health, they're the history of man. They have shaped the earth in many respects sociologically. But we may be the first generation in human history that's had enough information that we can prepare to do something not about preventing it, but about mitigating its impact. So now is the time for us to begin to act. Now is the time for us to create a nation of preparedness. Now, is this Y2K? Is this the little boy who cried wolf? None of us know when this will happen. History tells us it will. But in the context of doing this, we can become a safer and a healthier nation. We can have vaccines that will save millions over the course of the next 10 years in the annual flu and in pandemic flu. We can have antivirals that will help us in all settings. We'll have state and local preparedness that will make us a better prepared nation for any kind of a disaster. This is a moment for us to prepare, not just at the federal level, but at the state level, the local level, the business level, the church level, the school level, the college level, and the family level. It's a good idea, no matter what the disaster, to have some food stored. We live in a just-in-time economy. We use a convenience store and a 24-hour grocery store as our pantry. Well, that wouldn't work in a pandemic or a major earthquake or some other kind of disaster. It's general preparedness. We'll be a safer and a healthier nation if we do so, and now is the time for us to do it. Thank you.
Speaking of that surge capacity, the New York Times on Sunday said there's a shortage of ventilators that were in the surge capacity situation in our hospitals. So whose responsibility is that? Is that the federal government to stockpile that, or is it back to the local authorities?
We are spending millions, hundreds of millions in more supplies, 50 million masks, thousands of new ventilators, and so forth. But despite that, the federal government will not have in a pandemic the capacity to supply every local community. And it's an important message to communicate. I heard a federal or a city health official say, what the federal government doesn't get is that everyone will be turning to their stockpiles at the same time. That's exactly what we do get. And it's the reason we're saying to local communities, the foundation of preparedness in a pandemic is local preparedness. If your hospital doesn't have enough ventilators, get more. If it's important to make that expenditure instead of remodeling the swimming pool, do it. One thing to remember, a pandemic lasts a year. There's no reason to believe that we won't have a hurricane or an earthquake or a bioterrorism event during a pandemic. So part of preparing is to make certain that we don't give up our capacity to respond to those more kinetic events during that period. It's one of the uniqueness, one of the uniquenesses of a pandemic and our preparation.
Thank you, Secretary Leavitt. You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services, Mike Leavitt, who has been talking about the current and future of the U.S. healthcare system. Our thanks to Secretary Leavitt, and we'd also like to thank the California Healthcare Foundation for his generous co-sponsorship of today's program and our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Brooke Byers, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.